From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Our daughter, Lori Berenson, has now been imprisoned unjustly in Peru for over 2.5 years. It's time for her to come home.
The Peruvian president rejects his prime minister's call for the release of Lori Berenson, who's serving a life prison sentence in Peru, will speak with her parents. Also, as the UAW continues to idle plants around their country in this strike, we'll hear more voices from the Black Radical Congress, including a veteran United Auto Worker talking with a young labor organizer. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton leaves for China today. His visit will be the first by a U.S. president to China since the Chinese Army's massacre of pro-democracy demonstrators around Beijing's Tiananmen Square in June 1989. The trip has been dogged by controversies for Clinton at home, including allegations that China attempted to influence the outcome of the 96 U.S. elections by funneling funds to the Clinton Democratic Party. China has denied any wrongdoing. The Congress is also investigating a decision by Clinton to allow Loral Space and Communications Limited to launch a satellite from a Chinese rocket while the company was being investigated for alleged transfer of sensitive U.S. missile technology to China. Loral's chair is a major donor to the Democratic Party. China's human rights record has also stirred opposition to Clinton's 9-day visit, and we'll have more on that later in the week. AT&T Corporation is acquiring the nation's second-largest cable television operator, Telecommunications Incorporated, known as TCI. The deal is expected to be worth at least $25 billion in stock. Meanwhile, a federal appeals court yesterday ruled that Microsoft does not need to alter the way it sells its software for navigating the Internet. The ruling struck down a lower court ruling last year requiring Microsoft to sell its Windows operating system software separate from its software for the Internet. Yesterday's ruling also struck down an injunction ordered against Microsoft in December after the Justice Department argued that Microsoft was using its monopoly to gain an unfair advantage in the market for browser software. The HIV pandemic is expanding dramatically in most poor countries, even as it plateaus or declines in the United States and other wealthy nations. This according to the United Nations AIDS program, releasing the first country-by-country analysis ever compiled for HIV, UNAIDS described acute differences in the spread of the virus. And AIDS rates plummet in North America and Western Europe because of prevention campaigns and improved treatments, the contrast between wealthy nations and the poorer nations in Africa, Asia, and Eastern Europe grows acute, this according to UNAIDS director. President Clinton has vetoed legislation imposing sanctions on firms that sell missile technology to Iran, setting himself up for an all but certain override in Congress. Calling the measure inflexible and indiscriminate, Clinton said it would require the imposition of sanctions based on an unworkably low standard of evidence. Earlier, Clinton's fellow Democrats said that if he rejected the bill, they would join with the Republicans who control Congress to override his veto, ramming the bill through despite his objections. And this news from Jakarta. Indonesian workers called off a planned protest today against the government of President-elect B.J. Habibie after armed troops surrounded their labor union office. Activists from the SBSI labor union said they would avoid a confrontation with the soldiers and were not planning to go through with the protest in front of parliament. But they said they would remain outside the union offices until soldiers who'd blocked off streets around the building were removed. The chief of SBSI is Mukhtar Pakpahan. He has said he would bring 10,000 workers on the streets during the protest, and the military commander for Jakarta had said troops would use force if necessary to prevent the demonstration. Pakpahan was just recently released from an Indonesian jail. Meanwhile, East Timorese reacted coolly today to a meeting between Nobel Peace Prize winner Bishop Carlos Jimenez Bello and Habibie and said fresh protests demanding a referendum on independence would be held tomorrow. Canada announced yesterday that 20 countries have already ratified the international treaty to ban anti-personnel landmines, half the number needed for it to come into force. Last December, 122 nations signed the document in Ottawa, and four more have affixed their names since then. 40 countries must ratify the accord before it takes effect. The League of Conservation Voters yesterday named six politicians whom it will try to keep out of Congress in the November election, saying they consistently have sided with polluters against the environment. The League, the political arm of environmental groups, targeted five Republicans and one Democrat for defeat in the first installment of its election year Dirty Dozen hit list. Among the Republicans named, Helen Chenoweth, John Hostetler, Bill Redman, Mark Newman, and Bob Dornan. That's some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Peruvian President Alberto Fujimori yesterday stood firm against pardoning Lori Berenson, who is serving a life sentence for treason in Peru, despite calls for clemency or a new trial from U.S. officials and his own prime minister. Fujimori told reporters, "My anti-terrorist convictions are firm. On this opportunity, I can say publicly and emphatically that she will not be pardoned and deported to the United States." Fujimori gained popularity by using extremely harsh measures to crush rebels in the early 1990s. This according to Lori Berenson, who was convicted of treason. He said she would get no special treatment because she's American. A military judge sentenced Berenson to life in prison in 1996 for helping the Tupac Amaru revolutionary movement plan an assault on Peru's Congress. This is what they said publicly, but in fact, the evidence presented at the trial was kept secret, and the judges in that trial wore hoods. Today, we're joined by Lori Berenson's parents, Mark and Rhoda Berenson. Mark Berenson is a statistician. He teaches at Brute College, part of the City University of New York. Rhoda Berenson is a physicist, a professor of physics at Nassau Community College in Long Island. Mark Berenson, we'll start with you. You just returned from Peru, where you visited your daughter at the Yanamayo prison high in the Andes. How is she?
I saw Lori on Sunday for Father's Day for the first time in many years. I had a chance to be with her then, and I was uplifted by her strength, by her spirit, by her convictions in herself, and that's what keeps her going. Physically, she continues to deteriorate. She suffers now from digestive problems and was promised an echogram by the Peruvian government this week to diagnose the exact problem. But nevertheless, her strength is remarkable, and I leave there with a tremendous sense of feeling of goodness about Lori.
Now, the latest political controversy actually happened after you left Lori on Sunday. We had the news yesterday that the Peruvian prime minister was calling for her release, and that he actually said that she had not been given a fair trial and that she had been wrongly charged, that a foreigner could not be charged with treason. But then this morning we have the news that late yesterday the Peruvian president, Alberto Fujimori, had said that he would not pardon Lori Berenson. Rhoda Berenson, what's your response?
Well, certainly we agree with the prime minister that Lori was unfairly charged, unfairly tried. I believe the prime minister also pointed out that the system that tried her was overly repressive. We certainly agree with that. And we certainly agree that she should be sent back to the United States. We were, of course, disappointed in President Fujimori's reaction. Fortunately, dialogue has opened up on this. We think that's for the best. But the problem is that President Fujimori continues to call her a terrorist. And we have always said, if you really can, let's see you prove it. Let's go to a court. We are convinced that the only reason they have not given her an open trial is because they have absolutely no evidence. Lori continues and even told Mark on Sunday, "Listen, I'm innocent. Either they give me an open trial or they let me out of here. Enough is enough."
The prime minister, named Javier Valle Riestra, clearly is making this a kind of political football between he and Fujimori. Now, this could mean that Lori Berenson won't be released as long as Fujimori is president, that he will make this the major issue, a major issue of his presidency. Or it could mean that it gets a lot of international attention if the prime minister keeps raising it and also, with that, raises the repressive judicial system.
That is true. I'm glad to see that Peru's prime minister has made the statement that she has not received justice and that their system is repressive. It's refreshing that in Peru, a country that discriminates against freedom of press, that discriminates against freedom of speech, that discriminates against people practicing their religion, is able to come out with such a statement because of the rank of his office. And it is time now for the world to see President Fujimori and his demonic, dictatorial system that we in this country give credit as a democracy. It is a disgrace to this program to say that Peru is a democracy. It is a sham. And only with people like Prime Minister Valery Estra can Peru ever emerge as a democracy, because President Fujimori, even in the words of Business Week on May 18th, Business Week says he tramples on democracy. And so I look forward to more dialogue now that the genie is out of the bag. Roeder and I are going to keep this case in the face of the world community.
Is it true that Fujimori takes Lori's passport around the world?
Yes, it is. He waved it on television the day she was arrested. That's how our own government found out. Peru didn't have the courtesy to call our State Department. They watched television with Fujimori waving her passport, saying, "This gringa terrorista will be brought to justice under Peruvian law." He took her passport on February 4th to Geneva to a conference on economics and investment and said, "We've captured Lori Berenson." He has singled her out as an American to show how macho he is to stand up to the United States. And our country lets him do it. It is disgraceful. I expect more from our State Department. I expect more from our National Security Council. And I expect more from William Jefferson Clinton.
We're talking to the parents of Lori Berenson, Mark and Rhoda Berenson. Mark Berenson has just returned from Peru, where he took that how many hour trip from Lima to the Yanamayo prison?
Lima to Yanamayo is a 2.5 hour plane flight and a 1 hour drive. It's an exhausting trip that I left on Thursday night and came back on Monday morning to find the surprisingly good news, the refreshing news, that turned so sour last night as the rug was pulled under by the political maneuvering of Alberto Fujimori, who wants to again run for president in a democracy where he has falsified the Constitution, probably not even been born in Peru, and illegally has been president of his country. And he just plays havoc on his system, having a bunch of goons in his Congress that say things outrageously about democracy and justice. They don't even have a clue what that is in that country.
Rhoda Berenson, the United States government has a close relationship with Fujimori. What has the State Department been telling you about Lori Berenson?
Well, the last couple of days, they have been telling us that they have been trying to work with the prime minister. They were aware of his statement that they have been consulting with members of the Peruvian government. We have to take their word that the word that we heard last night was that they want to increase the heat, but quietly. I asked, have they really turned on the heat to start with? We do have some sense that now there is an effort starting. It's 2.5 years too late, perhaps, but we did have press statements the last couple of days. We certainly want more.
A lot of people know about different countries through Hollywood, unfortunately, and there is a well-known movie that was made years ago called Missing, about Chile, also an American who disappeared in Chile, and a very devastating look at the U.S. relationship with Chile and how they subverted any efforts to find out information about him. Would you characterize the State Department in the same way in your daughter's case?
It's not only the same way. We watched Missing Again recently, and were amazed at the same language. There's a place in the film where they essentially tell Jack Lemmon, Mr. Horman, that we don't make policy based on your son. We have been told we do not make policy based on your daughter. It's, you know, individuals are expendable to a great extent. The State Department I look at now as a machine. It's not people.
Peruvian government gets the similar kind of support as other Latin American countries from the United States under the guise of the war on drugs. How close is that relationship, and do you see it getting in the way of any possible release of your daughter?
It most certainly is in the way. Our good general, Barry McCaffrey, gave money to a villainous slime, Vladimir Montesinos, while the State Department and NSC was telling us how they were working with us. This was late October 1996. One hand of the government, not knowing what the other hand is doing. I asked General McCaffrey to be a man. I asked him to stand up against the evils in Peru and stop this charade about anti-narcotics.
Vladimir Montesinos is quite a notorious name in Peru and among human rights activists who know about him. Well known as a man who was on the payroll of the Central Intelligence Agency. We had a Peruvian Congress member on the air months ago who was actually held captive by the Tupac Amaru at the Japanese ambassador's residence. And he talked about how Vladimir Montesinos was responsible for so much of the terror against journalists and just regular Peruvian citizens, and yet still on the payroll of the Central Intelligence Agency. Can you talk a little more about him and his central role continuing today as the right-hand man of Fujimori?
Well, last year, when it was reported in Caretas that Fujimori is illegally president because he was born in Japan and couldn't be serving as president, it was rumored that it was Montesinos who was protecting him and who knew this, and it was Fujimori who keeps Montesinos empowered because Montesinos has something on him. Peru is no democracy. It's a dictatorship run by President Fujimori, who was elected. But that's all it is. Democracy is more than elections, folks. And I want you to know that Montesinos was behind the scenes, along with a general named Hermosa, and those are the three that really run the country. Look at the lack of power of the prime minister. The prime minister is the chief cabinet minister. He said Lori didn't have justice. He said that she should be sent home. Now, Lori has said from day one, I am innocent of preposterous charges. Peru must give me a real trial in an open court. We're not afraid of that. Rhoda said that. What is Peru hiding from? What is Peru hiding from that this imbecile, Congressman Daniel Espejon, president of the Human Rights Congress, says the military courts have acted with honesty and transparency in convicting her? God damn it, give me a break. Show me. I'm the father, man to man. Show me the evidence, Mr. Fujimori, because I'm going to be in your face. I am going to hold demonstrations at the embassy. I am going to go down there. You want to kill me? You can do that. I am ready to die for my daughter. Are you ready to die, Mr. Fujimori? I am ready to give my life for my child. Enough is enough. Mr. Clinton, where the hell are you? You hide behind the doors. You do not answer the phone. You had time for 37 meetings in 9 months with a woman named Monica Lewinsky, the genius political advisor, and you don't have time to speak to me as a parent about my child? I want liberty and I want justice. Every human being deserves liberty and justice, but nothing more and nothing less. My daughter is innocent. She must have a chance to prove this to the world. And we cannot be disgraced by our own government or by the demonic government of Alberto Fujimori. And I am not giving up this fight. It's only begun, folks.
We tried to reach you, Mark Berenson, and Rhoda Berenson just 2 weeks ago when you were up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, because President Clinton was giving the commencement address at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where your daughter had been a freshman. Did you have any chance to speak to him there?
We did not, but entire dais was wearing ribbon, or close to it, wearing ribbons saying, Mr. Clinton, please free Lori Berenson, class of MIT class of 91. That included the Cambridge City Council. All were wearing these ribbons. We had banners, and we know that President Vest of MIT spoke with him about Lori Berenson. We don't know the exact words, but the gist was she needs your help, and that the president acknowledged that he knew that, and he would try to help.
Well, we're out of time. I understand President Fujimori is going to be at the UN for the microcredit summit at the end of this week. We'll let people know if there is a protest there. If people want to get more information on your daughter, Lori Berenson, where can they call?
212-689-3868.
That's 212-689-3868. Rhoda and Mark Berenson, I thank you very much for being with you, for being with us, talking about your daughter, Lori Berenson, again serving a life sentence in a Peruvian prison, sentenced by a military court she could not see and on evidence she could not see. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Just a young girl with ideas all her own. Working with the people in a land far from her home. Hateful of a government, so cruel and so unkind. Riding on a bus that day in November 95, arrested, taken away, you see, to a courtroom to be tried. The charge was conspiracy to bring down the regime.
And that music we're playing in the break is called A Voice in the Wilderness, the ballad of Lori Berenson, written by Larry Stoltenberg of Ames, Iowa. He is singing it as well. And if you'd like to get a copy of the full song, you too can call that number that the Berensons gave, 212-689-3868.
In a prison cell on a mountain far away, praying for us to raise our voice.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move now to Chicago, where we were yesterday as well, bringing you some of the voices of the first Black Radical Congress, which took place this past weekend. More than 2,000 people participated, from trade unionists to youth activists, prominent academics, and community organizers. Today, we're going to bring you an interesting intergenerational dialogue that took place there on the first night of the Congress. This in light of the fact that General Motors problems continue to mount, from strikes at two parts plants in Flint, with more than 142,000 GM employees laid off as a result. The Corvette plant in Bowling Green, Kentucky, was forced to cut production yesterday. And at the UAW convention in Las Vegas, the president of the Canadian Auto Workers Union announced their workers won't accept parts produced by dyes moved out of Flint prior to the strike. GM moved dyes crucial to their new full-size trucks out of the plants before the strike began. That first night of the Black Radical Congress was a series of intergenerational dialogues. The one we'll play for you today is between General Baker and Kim Deal. General Baker, a legendary Detroit activist, part of the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement, later the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. He's an organizer with the United Auto Workers and chair of Revolutionaries for a New America. He speaks with Kim Deal, a labor activist who organized public service workers at the University of North Carolina. She now works with the Institute for Southern Studies in Durham, North Carolina.
I just wanted to say, while everyone's sitting down, it's really nice to see so many people here, and it's really refreshing. The other thing, too, is General and I have been talking, and I've also made a lot of other friends, too, and these dialogues need to continue, not just on this panel, but this is sort of a model for everyone to really build a community and for us to really start to learn about each other and really become inspired. So. My first question comes from your roots. I'd like to know how living in Detroit and coming from Detroit really sharpened your political and spiritual analysis, and How does that continue today?
Thank you, Kim. I'm also impressed by the crowd we got here today, and it's really a pleasure to stand up here and try to share experiences and talk about some things that we might could share that could be helpful. To answer your question, I was born in the city of Detroit in 1941 to an auto family. My father preceded me in the auto plants. You know, when you live in Detroit and you grow up there, almost every young black male in the 60s went to the auto plants one time or another. We called it baptism. So I was baptized at the Dearborn Assembly Plant in 1963. And I pretty much stayed inside the auto plants until the day. I'm still at the Dearborn facility as I stay here now. I want to say that my commitment to struggle kind of developed out of that period of time. We were kind of fortunate in the Detroit area during the 60s when a lot of other cities and activists had to work off of poverty program money. The plants in Detroit was running. They were running Hemis and Barracudas and Chargers, so you could get a job in Detroit. And therefore, our little movement that developed in the city had an independent base that wasn't tied to government money. And I think in a lot of ways that helped kind of characterize and determine what kind of movement broke loose there. I want to say, like, my real commitment to the struggle kind of developed in stages as a youth coming up in Detroit and studying black history and getting all the way through Highland Park Community College and Wayne State University, and don't know that the first mosque existed right there in Detroit. Those kind of things make you so angry, you go to searching your soul and everybody else to try to find out what's the roots of black history here. I got one level of commitment then. I got another level of commitment from a period of time when I had an opportunity to listen to Radio Free Dixie and Robert Williams blowing from Cuba about a black man standing up and fighting back. And that was another level of commitment that I went through. My real level of commitment came in about 30 years ago, around July the 12th, 1968, when we had our first strike at DRUM, the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement. When we set up conga drums in front of the plant early that morning, we set up picket lines at the gates, and in a half hour, we had 6,000 workers standing in the streets asking you what to do next. And you know we didn't know. But when you see workers that never said anything before, real quiet, and stand up and take the floor and become the most militant on the line, then you got a real commitment to those people. And you got to figure out what you're going to do now to straighten out your life, to try to beat and lead them to this point and don't know what the next step to take, and commit the rest of your life to trying to fight some kind of way for them to make an expression of the struggle that we face with. So that's the level of commitment that I had. Those are the things that wedded me to that struggle where you can't retreat from it. And those are things I want to try to share with you, because it's a real meaningful thing when you got that many people standing out looking for you to lead. You don't know what to do next because you hadn't thought far enough to think that they were going to stand with you to begin with, that you could think about what step to take next. So, Kim, that's a way that I kind of, in a real way, that kind of led to my commitment and conviction and struggle that I had there in the city of Detroit.
On that same note, talking about DRUM, I had the chance to read Detroit, I Do Mind Dying, which is a great book talking about the Detroit auto worker strikes, and it's just a great piece of black history, a piece of great history itself. I want you to talk a little bit more about DRUM and your involvement with that, and also there are a lot of unique aspects about it, especially the sense of community, and I'd like for you to talk about how you maintain that and how it really thrived.
Sure, I'd like to say, I think it's a couple other things that's important. You know, as the movement started early in the 60s, you know, like it went in most cities, we had a lot of weekend rallies. We come together in parks and had, I remember we elected a black people's parliament in the park on the weekend. And that was the expression of the movement, it was a weekend movement. You know, people came and put on their garb and talked stuff all weekend and went to work and kissed butt and beat black kids for a living and did everything else throughout the week. You know, and that was the thing that we had to try to deal with. How are we gonna carry the struggle Monday through Friday? But I think we got our greatest lesson during the Detroit Rebellion. In 1967, during the Detroit Rebellion, when the 101st Airborne held down the East Side, and the state troopers and the National Guard held down the West Side, and they declared martial law in that city. You couldn't do nothing. The kids got sick. You couldn't go to the hospital. You ran out of food. You couldn't go get none. But if you had a badge from Ford, Chrysler, General Motors, you'd get through all the police lines in the area to get to work. We learned a fundamental lesson that the most important place we occupy in society in this city in 1967 and 68 is at the point of production. And therefore, we took that lesson back to the Senate. Now, that estimate didn't fall out of the sky. It was a practical assessment of studying the situation we were confronted with and figuring out how to move. And that's why we proceeded to carry out the work in terms of shopping the plant. It was so overwhelming that once the drum strike took place, it just mushroomed around the country. We had certain conditions then, I think it's important to say, that don't exist today, so people don't think you could just copycat the same thing. You know, back in the early 60s, plants were stable. They stayed in one place. We didn't have the massive plant closings. There were institutions where the corporate power had to close the plant in order to get rid of the revolutionaries out of it. We had those kind of things back in those days that were real stabilizing. Today, it's a lot different. Today, you have international unions and union leaders in collaboration with the company. If you get a person elected at a local, will have that plant closed and the work sent somewhere else just because of the politics of the person at that local. Things have changed. Changed the days that GM is so strong they can sneak in the middle of the night like thieves and steal dyes out of the plant in Flint and close it. So they're not really on strike. They've been called out in Flint, Michigan. You know, when a company can steal dyes from you while you're on Memorial Day weekend barbecuing and you come back Monday and the dyes are gone, your hand's been called. So we got a different situation than we confronted with then that needs different analysis and estimates of how we carry out those struggles. Kim, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions if I could. And I understand your background is Southern organizing, and that's so important for us because obviously the patterns that we find and we're able to do in the North don't necessarily fit the patterns of the South. But I'd like for you to express some of your opinions, some of your experience from Union Summer, some of your other experience from unionizing in the South, kind of give us a flavor of that if you can.
So much of organizing in the South is really a battle of ideologies. I mean, the word union is just, it's a really bad word. And so one of the main points we have to start at is to really convince folks that of what the union offers. And when I went to Union Summer, there were a lot of contradictions, and it was really hard in a lot of ways to be a young black organizer in the South. I was in South Carolina at Hilton Head Island, which is a plantation. It literally is. Black folks are bused in from Savannah, Georgia, about 2 hours away, and they're forced to work on a remote island for white people who play golf all day. And then they're bused back and they make about $5 an hour, and they don't get paid for the 4 hours of transit. And so we faced, at Union Summer, we faced a lot of harassment from not only management, but also a lot of community members in the South, in South Carolina. We weren't welcome. We were a scary group. I mean, it was something new. I think one of the wrong tactics for that particular campaign was that we were just thrust into this community and we were expected to just talk to people and have everyone really be friendly with the union. And a lot of folks weren't ready for that. And we weren't, we faced a lot of racism, not only from the union, from union officials, but from the management and a lot of sexism. And so my experience with Union Summer was really difficult. I learned a lot and it shaped my political analysis incredibly. I wouldn't be the same person if I hadn't done it, but it was also painful as well.
Kim, I'd like to also ask you, in a lot of ways, I know oftentimes when we were struggling in some of the drum plants, we had to have a kind of a character that was independent of both the union and the company in order to carry out that battle. I want to know kind of what are your experiences in the South along those lines in terms of what are you fighting for in that sense, along those lines in terms of trying to organize.
Actually, could you clarify the question a little bit
more? I know our experiences have been we had to try to carry on a kind of an independent struggle that was neither tied necessarily as a caucus to a union or tied to the company in order to carry out our struggles at the shop. If we had been tied into a caucus, we'd been boxed into the institution and couldn't fight it out. And our goals had to be a little broader than just unionization. And so what I'm asking you, in a lot of sense, in your experience in organizing the South, kind of what is you after, or where is your goals leading you to?
Yeah, you're right. The goals are a lot different. It's the goal in the South isn't to get a contract and bargain collectively. There's no collective bargaining, and so really the goals are a lot different. We start with getting folks together and really talking about what the grievances are. For instance, with the housekeepers, and where those grievances come from. Really being able to target the problem areas so that people don't get frustrated and burned out, because often there's just so many battles, you have to figure out which ones to fight and where they're coming from. And in a sense, there's a lot of freedom with that. You know, it's you're kind of an independent, from what the feeling I get is you're an independent union, because there's so few in the South that you kind of, you can't really do whatever you want, but whatever you're doing is pretty new. So there's a lot of freedom in that, and it's not necessarily new in the sense that it's never been done, but it's just really sporadic at the moment. And what we really need to do is organize the South. The main thing I'm really coming to realize as I'm building my political consciousness, and it's very Southern based, is that the South is incredibly important in this economy, in terms of the global economy, and we really need to pay attention to that. Yeah, I have one question for you, especially, I haven't been an organizer for a while, Jen, and I was wondering, what do you consider some of your gifts as being in terms of being an organizer, an activist, an agitator, a leader? What do you consider some of your gifts, and how are they manifesting today?
Thanks, Kim. I don't know if you would, I guess because I got a little protracted background, a little bit of history struggle, one of the things is really having enough patience and caring enough to listen to the grievances of those you're trying to organize, and to try to figure out a way to try to educate and anticipate, and that becomes quite difficult. I guess one of the best examples I can give you of that is that I never forget back in during the period of time when rebellions were sweeping across the country, that when Rochester, New York, and Harlem went up in 1964, and Watts in 65, and Cleveland and the rest of the cities in 66, people around Detroit were saying Detroit ain't gonna never blow up because people working here making too much money and they living too good, so we ain't got to worry about that. Matter of fact, it helped null the police department to sleep a little bit because folks doing so good it ain't gonna never blow. And then when the rebellion broke, it was the biggest one yet. So I just want to say that because you got to figure out a way to kind of listen and anticipate. And I say that because oftentimes you turn your back and want to give up and quit right at the time when people are prepared to struggle. So it's the kind of patience and understanding that you got. Another thing I want to tell you is that we got to have the ability to persevere and to keep struggling. And all kind of adversity. I mean, I got a job. I'm working at Ford Motor Company right now. I'm a furnace operator on midnight shift on C-Blast furnace. And I was blacklisted out of the auto industry, but I went out and got me a new name and a new Social Security number. And I went back to work. Now, it ain't a whole lot of me's, and I knew a whole lot of guys, women and people in the plant that knew me from before, and I'd act like I'd got, quote-unquote, sedity. and I worked for 19 months and wouldn't speak to none of them. I had learned that in the union contract that if I could get by a year, that I was safe. Anyway, they caught up with me after 19 months, and they fired me for falsification of application. My case went to arbitration, and they restored my job with my right name because it was already 7 months over the limit. I want to say that because we just can't quit. We're not free to quit. I had my police files. You can see the police files now, and the police files say that the State Police of Michigan notified Ford Motor Company that I was working at the Ford facility on a different name. Then I got 2 weeks later, Ford Motor Company comes back to the police, say they can't find me. Now, even though there might have been leaks in the organization that understood I was working there, nobody never knew which name I was working under. So once again, I was safe and they couldn't find me. I just want to say those examples so as we got to persevere. And as mighty as they are, even with the state police informing and all that other stuff, I got through and worked 19 months on them and they couldn't discover me. I want to say that's important, I think.
General Baker, legendary Detroit activist and organizer with the United Auto Workers and chair of Revolutionaries for a New America, speaking with Kim Deal, a labor activist who organized public service workers at the University of North Carolina. She now works with the Institute for Southern Studies in Durham, North Carolina. They were both at an intergenerational dialogue in the first night of the Black Radical Congress that took place this weekend in Chicago, where more than 2,000 people gathered. When we come back, we'll hear another conversation between a younger and older activist, Kim Springer, who's part of the Black Feminist Movement, graduate of Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, and Barbara Smith, a Black lesbian feminist writer and activist. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
If you see me stumble, don't stand back and look on. Be child now, brother. Give your hands to struggle. Give your hands to struggle.
Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. It is Lesbian and Gay Pride Month, and around the country, particularly this weekend, will be events honoring this month. We're now going to bring you a conversation between Barbara Smith and King Springer, both at the opening event of the Radical Black Congress, the Black Radical Congress that took place in Chicago this past weekend. Barbara Smith, Black lesbian feminist writer and activist, worked in the civil rights movement in the early 60s and in opposition to the war in Vietnam. In the 1970s, she was co-founder of the legendary Combahee River Collective, a grassroots feminist organization based in Boston, later co-founder with Audre Lorde of Kitchen Table Women of Color Press, the nation's first press dedicated to women of color. She now works with the Feminist Action Network in Albany, New York, editor of several collections, including Homegirls, a Black feminist anthology. She is interviewed by Kim Springer, an activist from Atlanta, graduate student at Emory, documenting the history of the Black feminist movement. As an undergraduate at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, Kim Springer was an organizer with United Coalition Against Racism and the Ella Baker Nelson Mandela Center. Kim Springer begins.
You're often introduced as Barbara Smith, Black lesbian feminist activist, and some people seem to think that doesn't mean that you're involved with the Black struggle. So I wanted you to talk somewhat about your political activism.
Starting when, Kim? Before we go any further, I just want to tell General Huzal presentation and interview I enjoyed so much. You may not believe it, but I'm actually a member of the United Auto Workers because I'm also a member of the National Writers Union, and we are part of UAW, so I want to just say that. I read Solidarity every month. Well, you know, that goes back a long way. How did I become politicized? I became politicized by being raised by a family of Black women who were completely unrecognized as human beings and as people with their own agency in this country, in this society. Because I grew up in the 1960s and came of age in the 1960s, I had that rare opportunity, as others have already spoken of, to attend what I called a school for life. Because, see, all we had to do during those days was to turn on the television or to read the newspaper, and we saw the glaring contradictions of this society being played out in front of our faces. As I said, sometimes like you could not tell the news footage from Watts, from Detroit, from Cleveland, where I grew up, from what was going on in Saigon or in Soweto. So It was just being there. It's hard for me to believe that anyone could be a part of my generation and not be politically active and radical, but of course many fell through the cracks.
My next question relates directly to the BRC. One of the principles of unity of the BRC is opposition to homophobia. So I wanted to ask you, how easy or difficult has it been to incorporate issues around lesbians, gays, bisexuals, and transgender people into the agenda of the Black movement?
Not easy. I asked Kim if she was nervous before we went up here, and I wasn't going to tell her that I was nervous because I figured that was not good to let her know that, but I was nervous, and I'm still a bit nervous because since, for the introduction, Barbara needed material for me, and I thought, now how do I get this in? You know, how do I say that I've been involved in these major movements for human liberation, including the Black liberation struggle, including the women's movement, including the anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist struggle, and including the struggle against homophobia and heterosexism. I said, oh, I know, I'll just say I'm a lesbian. That should do it. But but it does, it always raises the blood pressure. It always raises the blood pressure. One of the things coming to the BRC, and I've been telling my friends about this for just weeks, that is telling them about the particular thing I'd be doing here. They've been hearing about the BRC ever since I found out about it when the organizing first began a couple of years ago. But the thing is that I would tell my friends when I was talking to them more recently, I said, you know, I'm going to go to the Black Radical Congress and I'm going to be on this, you know, opening panel with all these legendary activists, you know, of my generation. And you know what? It's the first time I have ever been included in this kind of context in my life. Thank you. Thank you. That's incredible. I don't know why y'all are clapping for yourselves. Thanks for clapping for yourselves. But then the other thing I thought, as I was packing, you know, getting ready to go to the airport yesterday morning, I said to myself, and you know what? Even though it took this long to be invited, at least when I was invited, everybody knew what they were getting, you know? Like, what you see is what you get. It has been really, really, really hard. Hard to the point of tears. Hard to the point of hearts breaking over and over and over again. I don't know what motivated me in my youth to be out as a Black lesbian in the 1970s. I really cannot tell you what motivated me in particular, and perhaps had I known all the dimensions of difficulty it would have occasioned, I would have kept my mouth shut. However, sometimes when I've been asked that very question, I said, well, you know, my grandmother who raised me, who was born in 1887, I don't know if she was born in Dublin, Georgia, but everybody in my family came from way down in Georgia, not Atlanta, way down between Savannah and Macon, Dublin. Anybody ever heard of it? Little town, right? So my grandmother who raised my sister and myself, one of the things that she taught us among the many others that I value and I believe utilize until this day is that we must always tell the truth. Telling lies was such a terrible thing, and I know you know what I mean, those of you who are raised in that way. Telling lies was such a bad thing, the word was not even used in the home. It was untruth. You know, you can't tell an untruth. The word lie was so bad. And I think about that as I watch those who run this country, you know, who lie all the time. They just lie, 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 lie. But I think that's a part of just an integrity, a sense of principle, a sense of, like, why not? And then also a sense of community, which I have helped to build. There are two people, and I'm glad I didn't forget to mention them. There are two people who are gone now, who are of the ancestors, who actually did a lot of this work both with and before me. And they are Pat Parker, brilliant poet, revolutionary, an activist, and Audre Lorde, brilliant poet, writer, and revolutionary. And I was colleagues with Pat. Like, you know, we knew each other because we were involved in the same kinds of things. I was friends with Audre for 16 years. It helped me. It helped me to know that there was at least one other someone who was trying to do this at the same time that I was trying. And it feels good, to, as I said, to have done it the way that I've done it.
Okay, as evidenced by the president's, excuse me, I'm nervous, sorry. As evidenced by the presence of so many young people here today, not everyone in my generation is cynical and jaded yet. So, my question is, what wisdom can you share with us about keeping cynicism at bay? In other words, how do you keep the faith that revolution is possible?
That's something that I get asked often because people see me running around doing organizing and like pushing other people to organize sometimes, and they really do wonder why and how I have not become jaded. I think the major thing, someone asked me, who I worked with at Kitchen Table for many years, she asked me that just a few weeks ago, and I started going on this long, long discussion, getting into this long discussion about being a socialist. And I said, well, you know, in socialism, there's something called a dialectic, and that means that whatever is now is going to be different by and by. Everything must change, you know? And so I was talking about, you know, being a socialist and talking about understanding that in order to make a revolution happen, that you have to live as if revolution is possible always, that even if it doesn't seem to be apparent, that every little act you do that is toward justice and toward freedom is going to help to make that happen. We have been given, with this moment here, this weekend, building after years, we finally have come back together to say that we're tired of handouts, we're tired of rollbacks, we're tired of accommodationists, we're tired of assimilationists, we're tired of people who think that because they make a nice 5- or 6-figure salary that there's no need for black revolutionary struggle anymore. We have been given a moment to move, and the reason that we're ready to move is because we kept alert, you know, in the meantime, and we will continue to keep alert. So to me, that's why. But then when I went home after that conversation, I thought, why didn't I tell her it was because I was black? Because, see, that's a part of it, too. And I always say, like, if anybody had asked in any time, like, up until the abolitionist movement in this country, if anybody had asked in 1682 or in 1751 or in 1799 or 1801, would black people in this country ever be free? The answer would not have been no, it would have been hell no. And yet, you know, on paper, and it really is on paper, we are by law no longer enslaved. So to me, if I can come from that tradition of struggle, there's a lot we will be able to do. I'm gonna ask you. Cam reminded me that we had met each other when I attended her graduation and another friend's of mine graduation at the University of Michigan several years ago. And I really consider the Michigan group to be legendary in and of itself. I met so many wonderful people, including Barbara Ransby, Kathy Cohen, and others who came out of Michigan. But I was wondering, how did you get involved in political activism? How did you become radicalized?
I would say that my parents are subversives and they don't know it. My father works at the Rochester Products Plant for General Motors in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and my mother worked for Michigan Bell. So they had different literature on the table that, you know, my father would get with his union membership, and I don't think he knew I was reading it, but in that way I feel like it was subversive. Also, my mother would show me slides and things to supplement my education at home, to sort of make up for the things that I wasn't getting at school, because though it was the early 1970s and everybody in my house had an afro, that didn't necessarily mean that we were particularly radical or involved with a movement. So she would show me films about Langston Hughes and the Black Arts Movement and just educate me at home, so I feel like that had a lot to do with it. And then when I went to the University of Michigan, I met people like Barbara Ransby and Tracy Matthews and Kim Smith and many others who showed me that I didn't have to assimilate. I was already in the place where I needed to be, and there was work to be done there. And so I've tried to carry that with me into my classrooms, and sometimes I feel like I might get in trouble for that, but that doesn't really matter to me because I'm still encountering many students who come into, I don't know if you're familiar with Emory University, but it's a predominantly white school, very rich, and so students come in, black students, feeling like they've made it already. Mm-hmm. But as we can see from the rollbacks in affirmative action, particularly on the West Coast, they are not safe. And I feel like it's my duty to help them keep that in mind and think of ways that we can make it better for others after us.
Kim also has been in contact with me in the last few months because she wants to interview me for her dissertation, which is on the building of the Black feminist movement. And I really would like you to share more with everyone here about why you chose that topic, what you think you'll be finding, etc.
One of the main reasons I chose to work on history of Black feminist organizations was because I didn't see too many other Black feminists around me. I mean, I saw women of your generation who I looked up to, but yet it seemed like there was a distance between you and I. So I sought to bridge that distance by studying the organizations and also figuring out what happened to Black feminist organizations, what were the strengths and weaknesses of those, and how can we carry them into the future. But another reason I chose it, one of my advisors asked me why I wanted to do this particular dissertation on Black feminists. And to be quite honest, I told her because I want to prove that I am not wrong, that it is possible to be a Black woman and to be a feminist or a womanist, but whichever label you choose, the work needs to be done.
I think you touched on something that concerns me and that we talked about yesterday at our Black Feminist Institute, and that is the fact that to me, Black feminism has never been able to fully establish itself as a grassroots movement in our many Black communities all over this country. Although I met Black feminists from all over the country and from all over the world, somehow it has been perceived not to be a grassroots bread and butter movement. Now, the way we did it in Combahee, it was a grassroots bread and butter movement. Yeah, like when they murdered, Combahee actually grew out of the National Black Feminist Organization, which we thought was too mainstream and too into reforms as opposed to radical change and revolution. So after being involved with the National Black Feminist Organization, which itself was founded in 1973, Combahee renamed itself, it had been a chapter of the National Black Feminist Organization in 1975. In 1979, after working on a number of issues, beginning probably in January of that year, Black women's bodies, actually the first people to be found were teenagers. Black women's bodies began to be found murdered in Boston, in the South End and in Roxbury, the two communities of color, each of which I had resided in. At the time that the murders happened, I was living in Roxbury. And by the time the spring, you know, had come, from like January through the end of April, 12 Black women had been murdered, sometimes more than one a week. And because of the kind of work that we had done in Combahee to bring together issues of racial oppression and of gender oppression, or sexism as we called it then, we were ideally positioned to be a bridge between all the various communities who were incensed, up in arms, and ready to fight back around these murders. Most people, when they think about Black feminism, they don't think about, you know, being at a community school in the South End in Boston, talking to working women, mothers, some grandmothers, about health issues like we did. You know, they don't think about us going to a construction site in Roxbury. And of course, Boston, as we know, especially in the 1970s, was a cauldron of racism. And the thing is, they don't think about us going to a construction site in Roxbury to protest the fact that Black and other men of color were not being hired to do construction on city schools.
Barbara Smith, Black lesbian feminist writer and activist, co-founder of the Kitchen Table Women of Color Press, also co-editor of the New Reader's Companion to U.S. Women's History, speaking with Kim Springer, an activist based in Atlanta, one of the organizers of the United Coalition Against Racism. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Hisu Ku and Jeremy Scahill. Errol Maitland's our technical director. Special thanks to Janice K. Bryant, who recorded the Black Radical Congress. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.